Our next case is 2015-917, T. Ryan Legg Irrevocable Trust, UBS Trust Company, trustee versus Joseph W. Testa, Tax Commissioner of Ohio. Mr. Lloyd?
Yes, Your Honor.
Proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice and honorable judges, may it please the court. This case is about whether Ohio can tax a non-resident Delaware trust capital gain resulting from the sale of its S corporation stock. It concerns essentially the same issue as in Corrigan v. Testa, but here the non-resident is a trust. And before I go in too far, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal with myself or my co-counsel, Ms. Reeve Campbell. Brief summary of the facts. For context, Mr. Legg was a West Virginia Mountaineer. He moved to Northern Kentucky and lived in Cincinnati from 2001 until mid-2006 when he moved back to West Virginia and now resides in North Carolina. In November 2005, the Legg Trust was established for estate planning purposes, formed under Delaware law and with a Delaware trustee. 65 shares, that is 32.5% of Total Quality Logistics, which we'll refer to as TQL, was transferred. It's an Ohio S Corp, and that was transferred to the trust. In December of 2005, a purchase agreement was entered into, wherein it was an agreement to sell the shares that TQL had to Mr. Oakes, who was Mr. Legg's business partner, who owned 50%. And in February 2006, the trust sold its TQL shares to Mr. Oakes.
Mr. Legg, he was in Ohio at the time.
He was.
A resident of Ohio.
Yes, Your Honor. It was clear that Mr. Legg was a resident of Ohio.
And what was his relationship to the trust after he created it?
He was simply a potential beneficiary. He actually had no right, nor did any person have any right to any distributions from the trust until January of 2007. So,
and was he the only beneficiary of the trust?
I think that some of his family members were beneficiaries as well. His wife.
But he wasn't the trustee.
The trustee was a Delaware trustee. It was a U.S. trust.
Counsel, wouldn't your client's contacts or Mr. Legg's contacts with Ohio, wouldn't that distinguish this case from Corrigan?
Not at all, Your Honor. And Corrigan, owner in Mr. Corrigan, he was in Ohio quite a bit. He was the 79% owner. He was regularly attended board meetings.
He didn't live in Ohio.
He did not live in Ohio.
But Mr. Legg resided in Ohio.
Yes, Your Honor, Mr. Legg did, but the trust certainly was not in Ohio.
What is the transaction that gives rise to the request by the state tax commissioner to apply the tax? What happened?
Pardon?
Yeah.
It's the transaction, Your Honor, is the sale by the trust of its shares of TQL to Mr. Oakes.
And for federal tax purposes, is that a capital gains matter?
It is a capital gain, Your Honor. I think it might be helpful to
even though it was a sub S corporation, the federal tax was what to the trust?
To the trust, it was a capital gain, which the trust paid federal tax.
And the trust was the taxpayer.
The trust is absolutely the taxpayer as it relates to its shares of
For federal tax purposes.
For federal tax purposes. As in, while it's not relevant to this case, Mr. Legg's sale of his 35 shares, he was the taxpayer as it relates to those shares. The one thing that should probably be pointed out at the outset is that the trust is not an Ohio resident under Ohio law. The applicable section is 5747.01 cap I, print 3. The BTA held that the trust was an Ohio trust, Ohio resident, but it did that in error. Although Mr. Legg was certainly domiciled in Ohio, and Mr. Legg was listed as a beneficiary in the trust, what the BTA failed to do was look at the definition of a qualifying beneficiary, which the statute looks to determine whether or not a trust resides in Ohio. Because a trust resides in Ohio only if a person who is domiciled in the state for purposes of this chapter, that is Mr. Legg, but only if at least one of the trust's qualifying beneficiaries is a resident domiciled in Ohio. And the trust had no beneficiaries domiciled in Ohio because a qualifying beneficiary under, which is a statutorily defined term under 5701 paren I paren 3 paren C, means a potential current beneficiary, and that's defined under section 1361E2 of the code as any person who at any time during such period is entitled to or at the discretion of any person may receive a distribution from the principal or income of the client.
And so he was not entitled under the trust agreement, or he just didn't take any?
He was absolutely not entitled to it under the trust agreement. Sections 2.1A1 of the trust agreement said that it required the trustee to accumulate the net income of the trust and add it to principal. And all the testimony, Mr. Michael's testimony, the CPA in the matter, testified that they were required to hold it. There's an affidavit from U.S. Trust that said we can't distribute any of the money. And there's testimony from both Mr. Legg and Mr. Dovich, who testified that indeed there were no distributions. So they were not able to get any.
And what under the terms of the trust, then what would entitle the trustee to distribute?
After January of 2007, the trustee could then distribute under the terms of the trust from then on.
So it was a time bar.
It was time barred.
Right.
Counsel, didn't Mr. Legg have a statutory right to have access to the records of TQL?
So, Your Honor, you're now going into the qualified trust agreement piece. And I think that assuming that, and of course, but before we get there, I think that that answer is informed by the due process requirements, which were in Corrigan v. Testa. So if you, and of course, we say that Corrigan v. Testa applies. So therefore, if you've got a non-resident, for example, in Alex Signal, New Jersey was not permitted to include the gain realized in the sale of Bendix's stock in the former's apportionable tax base. So in other words, so in Allied Signal and in Corrigan, you know, this court basically adopted the Allied Signal holding, and they said that a non-resident cannot be taxed by in this case, Ohio, on their gain recognized on the sale of stock. And so when you look at the qualifying trust amount, and your question was how does it matter if that information was available?
Yes. Yeah, let me give a better lead in. Let's go to the qualifying trust amount issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
And did Mr. Legg have a statutory right to have access to the records, and does that make a difference?
Mr. Legg did have a statutory right to obtain records under the statute. However, if you look at that must be
informed. Isn't that enough right there?
It is not, because if you look at if it were enough in this case, it wouldn't. It was not enough in Corrigan, in theory, because you have to look at it from a due process standpoint too. And I think that if you go back and look at Alcan, the Alcan case basically said that They didn't have to address the due process issue in Alcan. They didn't have to address the due process issue in Random House. If the availability of the books and records to Mr. Legg, well, A, Mr. Legg is not the trust. But B, there's no relationship between the trust and the TQL that would warrant a taxation of this gain by Ohio in this instance.
What about the tax advisor, or the shared tax advisor? Does that matter?
That should not matter either. Mr. Michael was a CPA. He happened to be a CPA of quite a few of the actors here. I mean, he was TQL's CPA. He was Mr. Legg's CPA. He was the trust CPA. The testimony basically said that Mr. Michael eventually provided some of TQL's information to the Ohio Department of Taxation, which already had this information anyway, later on down the road. And Mr. Michael is not a representative of the trust. He's not a party to the trust. He's just their CPA. So the fact that Mr. Michael got access to that information as TQL CPA cannot be imputed to the trust. So in other words, the trust did not get that information from TQL.
And let me clarify, the question is not whether Mr. Legg had, that the records were available to him. Yeah. It was whether they were available to the trust.
They were available to the trust under that statute. They had a statutory right to them. They, however, also had this purchase agreement, which basically said that they couldn't get access to the records unless there was an event that occurred. And the clear testimony of Mr. Michael, actually, while the department was cross-examining him, was that the trust could not get access under that contract to those records. So if you were looking for a factual basis for that, then clearly the facts of the case show that the trust could not contractually get access to those records.
If we were to disagree and find that Corrigan does not control this case and the due process issue then is not resolved in the way you wish, does that totally undermine your position?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it is. I think that you could find a statutory I think that within the statutes as articulated by the brief, there is a way to hold, certainly there's a way to hold for the trust. However, I think that the better analysis is to adopt the Corrigan due process analysis and apply that to the statutes, through that lens.
If we agree with you, does this capital gain to the trust, is it subjected to any form of taxation, the transfer, the state of its domicile, the trust domicile?
If Delaware imposed an income tax, then it would be, but there's no, there was really no discovery as it relates to that, and the facts are just not there in this case as it relates to that. The record is absent of it.
Does Delaware have an income tax?
I do not believe that it does, Your Honor.
Okay, so what we're looking at is sophisticated people putting together a plan probably expressly designed to avoid state taxation of this transaction.
Or Mr. Legg could have just left in, if you really want to look at the facts and you really want to say, is this like Corrigan, Your Honor, you could just basically say what Mr. Ryan should have done was he wasn't that very sophisticated because he should have just left in 2005 when he and Mr. Oakes had problems, moved on back to West Virginia where he came from, and said, hey, here's where I'm at, and sold the stock in February, and you would have had Corrigan. So really, just because it was done via vehicle of a trust, the court shouldn't,
Well, I'm not suggesting there's anything wrong with advanced tax planning.
And there certainly is not, Your Honor. I've got 1 minute left, and I wanted to try to reserve five. I'm happy to continue to answer the court's questions, though.
Thank you. Mr. Fossey.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. If I can, I'd like to save 2 minutes for rebuttal. So really, there's kind of three big concerns I hear coming up today. So we have whether this trust is a resident as defined by statute, whether the trust can be taxed consistent with due process in Corrigan, and third, whether this is a qualifying trust amount. Let me start with the qualifying trust amount. The argument there is the books and records were not available because of this purchase agreement. Well, that's just wrong. So as this court held in Alcan Aluminum, 170137C gives every shareholder in Ohio a right to examine the books and records of the company they own shares.
But they said that there was an agreement, a purchase agreement, that waived that right.
That's not true. The purchase agreement actually provides an extra right for the trust that comes into existence after the stock has been sold. So what it is they're talking about the provision for a look-back period for the sale. The trust is selling its shares of stocks to Mr. Oaks, and they had a provision in there that said, look, within 5 years after this sale, if we find out you sold more stock for more than we paid for it, we want to be able to get some cash from you. We want to be able to increase our purchase price. So we get a 4-year look-back period from...
Wait a minute. The buyers wanted to increase their purchase price?
The seller.
Okay.
The seller said, look, the seller, who is the trust here, owned the shares of stock, said, if within these 4 years you sell it for more than you sold it to us for, we get a look back. So after I'm no longer a shareholder, after 170137 doesn't apply anymore, now I still have the rights under this look back agreement. That's section 2.1 of the purchase
agreement.
But
you're saying there was no preclusion, no inability for the books and records to be opened to the trust?
Absolutely none. There's none. In fact, like I said, the purchase agreement gives them extra power to look back at the books and records. And certainly the contract doesn't say, you know, this is a limitation on your rights as a shareholder. It doesn't say it's a limitation on your rights under 170137. So that's a complete red herring. They have absolutely a right under Ohio law. And next he says that the accountant maybe shouldn't have looked at the books and records. Again, that's nonsense. This was the trust's accountant asked by the tax department, can we see those books and records of TQL? And he, on behalf of the trust, got those documents, as he's allowed to do under 170137C. So again, the qualified trust amount is easy. That's a full stop on this case. Whether or not this trust is a resident, there's a full stop right there. This is a qualifying trust amount and is taxable to Ohio as Ohio trust income. But let's talk for a minute about whether this trust is a resident. So Ohio defines resident trust, 574701. And the only issue the trust has thrown up here, and we've heard this already today, is that there was no qualified beneficiaries for the tax period at issue. Again, we learned in law school, every trust has beneficiaries. You can't have a trust without beneficiaries. And really, the trust agreement here contradicts their argument that no distribution could be made. It's true that during the initial period, the trustees were to accumulate the interest and add it to principal. But section 3.1 of the trust agreement says the trustees have the power at any time to distribute the assets of this trust in cash or kind, at any time.
From the beginning of the trust until they sell.
It said the 3.1 says unqualifiedly at any time. And if you look at section 2.1C, the trustees...
Based on their discretion, there was no parameters. It's just at any time. That's power vested in the trustees pursuant to the trust agreement.
Yep. And don't take my word for it. Read the trust document. The section 2.1C says... the trustees can at any time, including during the initial period, expressly says including during the initial period, divide this trust up into smaller trusts and start distributing the assets. So the idea that there is no qualified beneficiary similarly falls apart under their own documents. So the trust is an Ohio resident for purposes of Ohio taxation. Again, full stop. There is no constitutional problem taxing a resident. Let's say you disagree with me. This trust isn't a resident. Then we look at due process. This court has said requires three things: connection to the person, connection to the activity and purposeful availment. So trusts are different than individuals. In the Corrigan case, you were dealing with an out-of-state individual. This trust was created by an Ohio grantor for the benefit of himself and his Ohio-domiciled families. The advisory committee for the trust was a lawyer and account firm here in Ohio. The corpus of the trust was shares in an Ohio corporation. The sale of those shares by the trust was done by purchase agreement to an Ohio resident, and that purchase was governed by Ohio law. Section 14.1 of the purchase agreement says this sale is governed by Ohio law. The only non-resident piece here is that they got a Delaware trust company to hold the funds. So you take the Delaware trust company out of it, only thing left is Ohio.
But
so of course due process
isn't that
is
the
satisfied.
Key?
I'm sorry?
I mean, isn't that the key? The trust is a Delaware trust.
Not for due process. No, because we're looking at connection to the person, the activity, and purposeful availment with Ohio. And here all three of those are met. The beneficiaries are equitable owners of the trust corpus. So a trust is an odd entity. It has a legal owner, that's the trustee, and it has an equitable owner, and those are the beneficiaries. Those beneficiaries have an equitable ownership stake in the corpus of the trust. And those beneficiaries are located here in Ohio. The sale was governed in this case. The income generating activity, which was the sale of this stock, was done under Ohio law. And that contract provides benefits to buyer and seller that are enforced under Ohio law. So there's non-compete agreements, there's indemnification, there's a look back period for the seller. All of those are benefits that they're deriving from Ohio. So Ohio sourced income, Ohio beneficiaries. You've got an Ohio grantor who, under this agreement, retained rights to do things like change the charitable beneficiaries of the trust, receive loans from the trust. All of these benefits flowing from Ohio under this trust. So due process, even if you decide I'm wrong, this is not a resident trust, due process is amply satisfied here.
You have an argument about dismissal. Did you want to address that?
You know, we advanced that argument, and it's correct. My client has an interest in getting to the merits of this, but we did notice as this case went on that there was a problem with the parties to this case.
Well, Mr. Legg is the one who authorized the suit.
Correct.
And your argument is that only the trustee can authorize the suit.
That's right.
Isn't that fatally defective, as you've articulated
yeah.
in your brief?
Yeah. And so what happened was, you know, as discovery unfolded in this case, we wanted to obtain documents and do depositions of the trustee, and we just kept getting stonewalled. We had a very difficult time figuring out who the trustee actually was.
Well, who is it?
During the time period at issue, so when, for our purposes, what we're saying are jurisdictional events are when you file a petition for reassessment with the tax commissioner and when you file a notice of appeal with the BTA. And during that period, the trustee was UBS. But both of those documents were filed on behalf of Chase, or I'm sorry, Charles Schwab. But Charles Schwab wasn't the trustee at this time. And like I said, we didn't find this out until weeks before hearing. And as soon as we became aware of it, we said, we have a problem here. You know, Ohio law 5808-01X says only the trustee can initiate actions on behalf of a trust. And it's not that as the trust claims, well, the proper party in interest was already here. If you don't have the trustee, you don't have the trust. You can't claim that the proper party in interest was always a party to this
case.
What
was Legg's role vis-a-vis the trust?
He was a beneficiary, and he was the grantor.
The beneficiary cannot authorize action on behalf of the trust.
That's correct.
So your point is this case isn't jurisdictionally proper here. It should be dismissed.
Yes, Your Honor. That's a motion we made to the Board of Tax Appeals.
But you said your client has an interest in the outcome of the merits.
Yeah.
So you're conflicted.
Right. So we advanced it. We have a duty to advance
it. Well, are you waiving it?
No, we're not waiving that argument. We're officers of the court, and we do have a duty to make all arguments that help our client advance their cause. Just in this case, as I said, you know,
and their cause to be advanced is the revenue. Is that correct?
It's the Department of Taxation.
It's not the law, it's the revenue.
Well, and Your Honor, we did cite the Hafiz case in which this court noted a jurisdictional defect but held that because the merits were so solid, so soundly against the appellant, that they didn't need to reach the jurisdictional defect. And that would be a fine outcome in this case for us. This is an area of law that we think needs some clarity, and so.
Would you comment on Corrigan and how Corrigan applies to this case or doesn't apply to this case?
Sure. So Corrigan involved a non-resident taxpayer, an individual who owned shares in Ohio S Corp and who resided out of state, and whose business was not selling shares of a stock. And this court looked at that and looked at a wholly different statute, Revised Code 5747212, and said, as a matter of due process, Ohio, you can't reach that income. This case, in contrast, has a resident trust. And we know residents can be taxed lawfully under due process. That's, you know, Ohio has a duty to ensure that the only thing we're reaching with our residents is Ohio income, and we do that. We carry that out through our apportionment statutes. But as I said, even if the trust isn't a resident trust, the due process concerns in Corrigan are satisfied here because you have Ohio beneficiaries who are the equitable owners of this trust. You have a trust whose advisory committee is here in Ohio, whose funding was done by a sale of an Ohio corporation to an Ohio citizen governed by Ohio law. You have a purchase agreement that, and so the purposeful availment part is met because you have a purchase agreement that keeps, that gives people rights to enforce under Ohio law, and you have beneficiaries in Ohio during the time period.
Counsel, then going forward, what's our test then that we would be using? Are we going to say in a case involving a trust, let's assume for the moment that it's a non-resident trust, are we going to say that's just the alter ego of a beneficiary, or what's our test going forward?
Well, so I think this court in Agley cited the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court McCandless case, and the court recognized in that case the simple fact that a trust is different than a person. And when you look at due process and you're looking for those minimum connections between the state and the taxpayer, a trust is different. A trust has those beneficiaries. It has that administration function. It has property that may be sitused somewhere else. And so I think there's nothing, you know, there's no reason to depart from Corrigan. I think that's your standard. But in this case, you say this is a resident trust, so the provisions of Corrigan don't apply. And even if it is a resident trust, the due process analysis that's set forth in Corrigan is met here. So if there are no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, you have a minute.
Your Honors, Reva Campbell on behalf of T. Ryan Legg. I'm only responding to the commissioner's cross appeal. And I know I'll keep this brief. First off, there is no proof in the record that Ryan Legg alone authorized the suit. From the beginning, what the board below found, and they're the finder of fact, they reviewed the witnesses, they had access to the credibility. They found that Greenbaum, that's our firm, has throughout the inception always represented the trust. They found nothing, no truth to the accusations, which are solely speculation. They have not a shred of proof. It was their own attorneys had a conversation that they took two weeks before the hearing, and 2 days before the hearing, less than 48 hours, filed a motion to dismiss. So we were scrambling. This is a non-issue. The trustee at the time was U.S. Trust. The UBS Trust, who was the trustee during the time of the hearing below, has no facts to help this case one way or the other. They were not the trustee at the time of the transaction or within the 2 years.
Who was the trustee to authorize this legal action?
U.S. Trust was initially, but Charles Schwab kind of got the ball rolling. And then subsequently—
Were they replacement trustees? Schwab?
Schwab, U.S. Trust, I believe Schwab purchased, or they merged. And so U.S. Trust really became Charles Schwab. And then later it became UBS Trust. When companies, all these trust companies have merged or sold, or when one financial advisor or trustee leaves one to another, that's when the accounts have moved. So right now, I believe we're on our fourth trustee because UBS.
Is there documents later, I mean, or addendums to the trust to show the sequence of successor trustees?
Yes, Your Honor, and those were provided at the board.
And so the correct successor trustee was provided for in an addendum to the trust agreement or document at the time that the action was filed?
Yes, the successive actions. There may have been a little bit of overlap where the new trustee knew about the case and was getting their ducks in a row to authorize and to ratify.
So they were new trustees, but the old trustee was still acting like the trustee, even though they weren't legally the trustee.
Correct. There was
and
a lag
so they
period.
Were, the old trustee was filing the actions, and the, really the new trustee was getting up to speed to figure out what was going on. So then the Well, if the new trustee was already ensconced as the new trustee, the old trustee didn't have the authority to do what you just said they did.
The new trustee knew about the action and were getting their ducks.
Knew about it, but...
And they didn't object. They said, we want you to keep going forward. That is not necessarily in the record. There is a letter in the record from UBS Trust that said they knew full well what was going on. They had no objections. But as with trust law, when you become a new trustee, you need to get up to speed. You can't just immediately... But also, if they were to say no, we would have blown statutory deadlines. But they always knew what was going on, had no objections to it, gave us the permission to keep going, ratified it, and then also engaged the firm.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, Counselor, do you have?
I had reserved the rebuttal, but unless there are questions, I'll let the court get about its business. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you call a recess?